Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Women in Political Power. With me to discuss women's political participation in the United States and across the world is Rachel Vogelstein. Rachel is the Douglas Dillon Senior Fellow and Director of the Women in Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. She is also a Professor of Gender and Foreign Policy at Georgetown Law School. Rachel has previously served as a Director of Policy and Senior Advisor in the Office of Global Women's Issues within the Office of the Secretary of State under Secretary Hillary Clinton. After her government tenure, Rachel was a Director of Women's and Girls Programs in the Office of Hillary Rodham Clinton at the Clinton Foundation and the Senior Advisor in Women's Issues on Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Rachel, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, Rachel, I will note that by chance today happens to mark the centennial of the pivotal vote by the Tennessee State Legislature to approve the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. It would subsequently be certified on August 26, 1920. And of course, the 19th Amendment is the amendment that gave women the right to vote. So I want to, begin there. I know you are involved in the work of the National Women's History Museum. So maybe you could just give us a few reflections on the significance of this centennial.
Thanks, Jim. We are indeed convening on an important day when the 36th state to ratify did so. And next week, we will commemorate what's known as Women's Equality Day on August 26th, when then Secretary of State Bainbridge Colby certified the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. You know, I think this is certainly a milestone in our own nation. And it is important to note what was gained and also that this was not a complete victory for women across our country. The 19th Amendment did make clear that the right to vote could not be abridged by any state or the federal government on account of sex. And that turned into a victory largely for white women to be able to vote. Despite the passage of the 19th Amendment, there were many other groups that still could not vote. Groups of women like Native American women who were not able to vote until the passage of the Indian Citizenship Act in 1924. Asian American women who waited until the enactment of the McCarran-Walter Act in 1952 in order to become citizens and vote. And Black women who, through decades of campaigning and advocacy, fought for the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which helped to eliminate many of the barriers at the state level to voting that obstructed the right for many African Americans in this country. So it's an important moment, but it was an incomplete stage of the fight for universal suffrage in our country. And I'll also note that this is an incredibly important anniversary for the United States, but it's also, I think, helpful to pull the lens back and look at the campaign for suffrage here as part of a broader campaign for women's rights around the world, which in fact predated the 1920 victory that women won here in the United States. The first nation to win the right to vote for women was New Zealand in 1893, and there were many countries, Finland, Australia, Canada, Norway, Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, Poland, Russia, in which women won the right to vote long before we did. But nevertheless, what happened here in the United States, as is often the case, was incredibly instructive to many other countries around the world. And so in this kind of post-World War I era, we saw the number of countries in which women won the right to vote really spike considerably, particularly in the 1940s, the 1950s, and the 1960s, which is when we saw over 100 countries grant women the right to vote. So this, of course, is an important milestone for women in this country. It also had an important effect on women's rights around the world.
Quite true. And I just will note two things. One, in the United States, some states had already given women the right to vote. And I will note, for example, that Jeanette Rankin was a member of Congress from Wyoming, and she actually voted against U.S. entry into World War I. She would stick around and vote for U.S. entry into World War II. On the state level, there had been success in getting women the right to vote in the United States. And I'll also say that we're sitting here having this conversation following news last week that Democratic nominee Joe Biden picked Senator Kamala Harris of California to be his running mate, making her only the fourth woman to be on a major party presidential ticket. I'm just sort of curious, because you know a lot about this era, Rachel. What do you think the people who fought for the 19th Amendment, for women's suffrage, to give women the right to vote, would think about the fact that 100 years later, we're only up to four women who've been on a major party ticket?
It is certainly momentous, historic news, not only that Senator Kamala Harris of California has been selected as Vice President Joe Biden's pick as a running mate. Not only is she the fourth woman to join a major presidential ticket, but she is the first woman of color to do so. And I think that's particularly important given the history that we just talked about, in which women of color fought long after their white counterparts to secure the basic fundamental right to citizenship, the right to vote. No, I think it is a testament to the progress that women have made and are making in this country that, you know, between 1984 and today, we now have several instances in which women have been part of a major party's presidential ticket. But I think it's also worth noting that there are many other countries around the world that have far outpaced the United States when it comes to women's participation in politics at the highest levels. So our country, of course, has never had a woman serve as president or vice president in its history. And that is not true for other nations. In fact, since 1946, 66 nations have had a female head of state. So in the post-World War II era and the modern era, there are many countries that have risen to break this barrier to gender equality. And the U.S. certainly lags behind in that respect.
Well, let's talk about that, Rachel, if we may, because you've done a lot of pioneering work on this, and you head our Women in Foreign Policy program, and you produced something known as the Women's Power Index. It's an interactive tool that ranks countries on their progress toward gender parity in political participation. So maybe you could sort of just talk a little bit about what the index does and how it's set up.
Absolutely. The Women's Power Index analyzes gender parity in political participation. And we look at several indicators of progress. First, whether women have shattered that proverbial highest, hardest glass ceiling and ascended to a head of state level, the proportion of women in parliament, the number of women who run for office each year in parliament as compared to men, the representation of women in the cabinet, and the representation of women at local levels of political office. And what we find is when it comes to women heads of state, that we have seen progress, but that overall women remain dramatically underrepresented. So there are currently, as you know, Jim, 193 countries recognized by the United Nations. And out of those 193, we currently have 21 women serving as heads of state. That is certainly a record as compared to prior decades, but nevertheless, as you can see, far fewer women as compared to men in the head of state level. We also see underrepresentation in parliament. There are only four countries out of 193 in which women have reached gender parity. And the same is true with respect to women's representation in political appointments in the cabinet. So there are currently only 14 countries that have reached gender parity in cabinet appointments as of earlier this year. The United States, as I mentioned, lags behind many other countries in our index. We do not make the top 10. In fact, on our Women's Power Index, the United States ranks 125th out of 193 countries in terms of its overall political parity score, which is an average of the indicators that I described. And indeed, we have only 17% female representation in our current cabinet, which is actually a record low as compared to the last several administrations. We have 24% women in our Congress. And as already mentioned, we have not reached the threshold of a woman as either president or vice president, although it remains to be seen whether that barrier will be broken in November.
Well, let's talk about what countries top the list.
There are a number of countries I think are worth mentioning that are at the top of the Women's Power Index. At the top of our index, Costa Rica, Rwanda, Sweden, Finland, Iceland, Nicaragua, Andorra, Norway, South Africa, and France. In some of those countries, we see that we've reached gender parity at the parliamentary level. Rwanda is one example. Certainly, gender quotas in parliament have been instrumental in many of the countries that I just mentioned, including Rwanda. In some of these countries, more than one woman has served at the head of state level. There are also a number of countries that round out the bottom of our index. Those are Qatar, Solomon Islands, Tuvalu, Iran, Haiti, Brunei, Kiribati, Vanuatu, Yemen, and PNG. And as you can hear from that list, there are a number of countries in which women face a range of barriers from gender-based violence at extreme levels, as in PNG, as well as a range of other factors that limit their participation across economic, social, and cultural life, which certainly affects their ability to participate politically.
I want to come back to some of these countries and some of the strategies countries use, particularly in the upper end of your scale. But I'm curious if you can sort of flesh out for us, what do we know about the consequences or the effect of moving toward gender parity for women in political representation? I assume there's been a lot of study done on this. And what does it tell us?
There have been studies done, although I will caveat that because women have been dramatically underrepresented in political leadership positions, we need more research in this area, particularly as the number of women in leadership positions rises. But here's what we do know from the research. In the aggregate, the evidence shows that women's leadership promotes bipartisanship, it promotes equality, and importantly, it promotes stability. And I'll just give a few examples. First, women's leadership matters because women are more likely to forge common ground across party lines. And I'll give an example from the United States, a study of the U.S. Senate that found that women senators more frequently worked across the aisle and ultimately passed more legislation than their male counterparts. And in recent years, we've seen examples of this, an instance in which female U.S. senators from both parties actually joined together to negotiate an accord to end a government shutdown. Women's leadership also matters because female lawmakers are more likely to advocate for policies that support education and health, a particularly critical finding in a moment where we face a global health crisis. There are studies that show that parliaments with higher numbers of women lawmakers are also more likely to pass and implement legislation that advances gender equality, including laws on domestic violence, on rape, on sexual harassment. And we've seen really compelling research among high-income countries in the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, in which the growth of the number of female legislators actually led to an increase in expenditure in areas like health and education. So not only were those issues higher on the priority list, but actually we saw greater investment. Women's leadership also promotes stability. So there's one study that finds that when women's parliamentary representation increases by just 5%, that country is almost five times less likely to respond to an international crisis with violence. And within countries, women's parliamentary representation is associated with a decreased risk of civil war and lower levels of state-perpetrated human rights abuses, such as disappearances, killings, political imprisonment, and torture. And finally, I would note that if one truly believes in democratic government and democracy, then one must be committed to the participation of women, because democracy without the participation of half the population is a contradiction in terms.
I agree wholeheartedly, and I think it's good that you ended on that broader point about the importance of having women, and I think a true democracy, all people have a chance to be involved and have a say, participate, and make decisions. I wonder, Rachel, if I can get you to talk a little bit about U.S. policy on this, because you've worked this issue for some time. My sense is there's been a commitment by successive U.S. administrations to promote gender equality, gender parity in other countries, particularly in developing countries or new democracies and the like. Could you sort of walk us through sort of a little bit of the history and the strategy the U.S. government has used to try to promote women? Because again, one that we didn't talk about, obviously there's a tremendous amount of evidence on the economic side, and your program has really done a lot to highlight it, that involving women in the economy, giving them a chance to participate economically has big economic benefits. But just talk us a little bit about sort of policy by the United States to help other countries diversify.
This really has been an issue that has risen in priority over the last several presidential administrations. Really going back to the Clinton administration, we saw the inclusion of women's rights as a core element of our national security strategy. The notion that when women's rights are respected, countries are more likely to be peaceful, prosperous, and secure. And we saw in the George W. Bush administration that this issue was elevated by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, with a particular focus on girls' education, which many studies have confirmed is perhaps the single best development investment that can be made because of the link between women's education and not only women's health and ability to participate economically, but also reductions in child mortality and promotion of literacy rates in children directly linked to women's education. We also saw in the Obama administration prioritization of this issue by the elevation of a new position, the U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues, a role that was created in 2009, reported directly to then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And not only did that have a profound effect in elevating gender equality on the U.S. foreign policy agenda, but we actually saw almost a dozen nations around the world take steps to create similar positions within their own governments, thereby having a catalytic effect in elevating this issue in other nations. In the present moment, you know, we still see that the commitment to women's rights remains in our current national security strategy, that there's a particular focus by the current administration on women's economic participation, which, as you rightly note, is critically tied to economic prosperity more broadly. And so I think what we can see from that trajectory, while there's certainly differences in many policies related to women's rights across those last four administrations that I've just mentioned, there is consistent bipartisan commitment to the notion that elevating the status of women matters to overall U.S. interests in prosperity, stability, and security.
Rachel, looking back on that history, and I agree with you, there's been bipartisan cooperation on the topic. Are there particular strategies that jump out to you as being more successful? Because it's certainly one thing to wish for countries to bring in 50% of their population and give them political rights and involve them fully in political life. But do we have a sense of what actual steps are most likely to bring about that result?
I have found, both in my work in government and outside of government as a scholar, that the proliferation of evidence, the data that shows very clearly the link between women's rights in a range of areas, whether it's the right to work, the right to participate politically, the inclusion of women in peace processes, the really strong evidence we have that women's participation in each of those areas redounds to our overall benefit to broader economic growth and shared prosperity, the increased likelihood that peace agreements are forged in the first instance and are sustained over many years, the effects of women's participation in the political process, which we just talked about earlier, that evidence has had a profound effect. And I think as the evidence base grows, we start to see not only nations change policy, but powerful multilateral institutions as well. So we have seen seen, for example, at the International Monetary Fund, the inclusion of indicators related to gender equality in assessments of economic health. Why? Because we know that when 100% of the population is able to work, as opposed to half the population, that means the economy is going to grow. And so I think that is not only a recognition of the importance of women's rights and of social justice, but it's also a recognition of the strategic economic imperative of full participation for women. And we've seen similar results at the UN Security Council when in the year 2000, there was the adoption of Resolution 1325, which called for women's participation in peace processes. Once again, that is certainly a human rights issue. It's a moral issue to ensure that women's voices are part of negotiations that certainly affect their lives as much as men's. But there was also a recognition of the strong evidence that women's inclusion has profoundly positive effect on advancing peace and stability that led the Security Council to take up and adopt that measure and promote it.
Well, I'm certainly glad to hear that facts matter, and what people keep telling me is a post-fact world. So that's a good news bit coming out of our conversation. But let me sort of turn the question around. Are there strategies that aren't particularly successful in trying to promote gender equality and women's participation in politics?
I find that, you know, despite this proliferation of evidence, while it's certainly been useful to make some of the important changes that I just discussed, we also know that there are tremendous gaps, not only the underrepresentation of women in leadership, but also when it comes to, for example, women's participation in the economy. There are still 100 nations around the world with laws that inhibit women's ability to compete in the workplace. And we know those are counterproductive to economic growth, and yet they persist. So there are a few factors that suggest that we might not succeed in promoting gender equality and ought to change policy accordingly. One of those factors is the lack of resources. There are many instances in which we see heads of state, where we see other leaders discuss the importance of gender equality, and then when it comes time to put a budget together, fail to prioritize this issue. Without resources, we won't have the programs, whether it's diplomatic programs or foreign assistance programs, to change some of the outcomes with respect to the gaps that I just discussed. So low resources, that's certainly one major problem. Another issue I think that can plague efforts to advance gender equality around the world is the failure to employ a country-driven approach to work with grassroots leaders who are often at the front lines of many of these battles within their countries and also have a keen sense of the cultural and political sensitivities. Without that knowledge, it can be quite challenging to make significant progress over a short period of time.
I want to go back to where we began when we were talking about the Women's Power Index, and that is the United States doesn't fare terribly well in terms of its ranking. It's pretty far down the list. So I'm curious, and again, because you've worked on these issues, what challenges does it create for the United States, for U.S. diplomats trying to go out and make the argument about the importance of empowering women when people can look at the United States and say, you don't have a particularly good track record. Perhaps you should focus on addressing these issues at home before you start coming abroad and providing lectures?
That's an excellent question, Jim. And when I had the privilege of working for the State Department and traveled overseas, you know, the very first question that I was confronted with as somebody who was there in my capacity as an expert on women's issues was, how is it that the United States has not yet ratified CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women? As you know, we're one of just a handful of nations that failed to take that important step, and our failure to...
I should note, the countries that have not ratified it are not countries we normally want to be associated with, is my understanding.
That is correct, as well as a very small number of island nations. So we really are on our own island when it comes to our failure to ratify CEDAW. But we, by failing to ratify, we have in some ways undermined the efficacy of that instrument in other countries, resisting its implementation, because the U.S. failure to ratify is often highlighted as a reason for failure to implement in other countries around the world. There are other areas where the U.S. lags behind most other nations when it comes to women's rights. Paid family leave is an example that I would give. We're one of, again, just 9 countries in the world without any form of mandated paid family leave for citizens across the country. So there are many areas, I think, where the U.S. certainly has work to do. And we mentioned earlier women's political representation as an incredibly important area where the U.S. needs to do more work and where we have yet to see sufficient progress. But I also think that we can't let the work that we still have in front of us limit our ability to engage on these issues around the world. In no country in the world have we reached gender equality or gender parity. And I think the history of not only the global women's suffrage movement, but even the current incarnation of the global women's movement, where we see transnational activism facilitated by 21st century tools like the internet and social media, that history teaches us that we have a lot to learn from one another in this ongoing fight for equality. And so the U.S. can, in my view, work to improve some of the policies that we need to hear, while at the same time joining with our friends and allies to press for progress for women around the world.
I think that's certainly the case, but I want to ask a question. Maybe I should have asked it earlier, about a technique that I don't think you can use here in the United States, but has been used elsewhere. And you mentioned it earlier, that is, many countries have quotas in terms of representation. How has that worked, or where has it worked? And what are the pros and cons of those sort of systems?
So interestingly, the United States tends not to support quotas within our own borders. But through our foreign policy, we have actually supported programs that advance quotas for women in other countries around the world.
So we have a little bit of a do as we say, not as we do kind of attitude on some of these issues.
We do indeed. One that I think should give us pause and cause us to question whether the notion that quotas are anathema within our borders is in fact the correct approach. Given the strong evidence that quotas work in other countries, it is certainly a tool that we ought to consider here. I will say that political parties have, in some countries and also in our own country, been more willing to think about quotas as opposed to reserve specific legislative or parliamentary seats for women. And that is a reform that perhaps could have some traction. In fact, in the 1970s, here in our own country, the Democratic Party changed its rules to ensure that for its political conventions, that there be balanced gender representation on state delegations. And that had a profound effect on women's involvement in the party, which is reflected in the much higher numbers that we see in terms of women's representation in the Democratic Party in the decades to follow. So that is one potential intervention that could have an effect here in the United States. But I think as scholars continue to analyze the rise in women's political representation, that this ought to be a tool that remains part of the toolbox and on the agenda.
We began our conversation talking about the centennial, the 19th Amendment, its passage. I'd like to close by marking or alluding to another anniversary, which is September will be, I believe, the 25th anniversary of the Beijing Conference. Could you sort of talk a little bit about the significance of that meeting and to what extent it has had a lasting impact on the topics we're talking about?
So interestingly, just as the suffrage movement that we are marking the centennial of here in this country was in fact a global movement, so too did we see the second wave of the women's rights movement in this country connected to a much broader global fight for women's rights, which took place really between 1975 at the first World Conference for Women in Mexico City, all the way through to 1995, where the UN held the fourth World Conference for Women in Beijing, which, Jim, as you rightly note, we will celebrate the 25th anniversary of this coming September. And that conference was historic in part because of the recognition that women's rights are human rights, which then First Lady Hillary Clinton famously proclaimed. But perhaps even more importantly, because 189 nations came together to adopt an ambitious platform for action, which called for the full and equal participation of women across economic, political, social, and cultural life. And since that time, we have seen, in this intervening 25 years, considerable progress made for women and girls globally in a few key areas. And I'll list just a few. The first is certainly women's health. The rate of maternal mortality, which previously stood at 500,000 women annually, has been cut in half over this 25 years. Education is another area where we've seen considerable inroads. We've seen in this 25 years the gender gap in schooling at the primary level virtually close globally. And while there's still certainly work to do within certain regions of some countries around the world, and there are still gaps at the secondary level for girls, nevertheless, there's now an entire generation of girls who are able to go to primary school, an opportunity that their mothers and grandmothers may not have enjoyed. We also have seen significant legal reforms. So the number of countries with laws prohibiting violence against women in 1995 stood at 13. And today it's 155 nations that have laws. Again, this is still an area where there's much work to be done, but that's a profound shift in that 25-year period. And then there are a few areas where we've seen considerably less progress in the last 2.5 decades. Women's economic participation has largely stagnated. In fact, prior to the onset of the current pandemic, we saw that the rate of women's labor force participation had actually dropped from 57 to 55% globally. I think as we continue to assess the fallout of the current pandemic, we will see that women's economic participation continues to decrease as women are contending with not only the health effects of COVID-19, but also the disproportionate burden of schooling and caring for children, the elderly, and sick, which is a phenomenon that women face around the world. We've also seen that while there's been progress in women's political representation, that of course women remain dramatically underrepresented, as we've already discussed, and that women's participation in peace and security processes continues to be elusive, that time and time again, peace agreements are forged without women's input, without consideration of women's needs, without capitalizing on their participation and talents. And of course, in an era of recidivism and conflict, you know, ignoring the strong evidence that women's participation promotes peace and stability is a challenge that all of us face. So there's been, I think, a lot that we can celebrate in this 25 years, and rightfully should celebrate, because these issues are often seen as intractable. And yet what we find is that when we set goals, as we did through the Millennium Development Goals and then the Sustainable Development Goal framework we currently operate under, when we dedicate sufficient resources, when there's political will, we can actually make progress towards gender equality in record time, as we've done in women's health, education, and to some extent, legal rights. But when we fail to take those steps, then we see stagnation. And so there's certainly quite an agenda for the next 25 years.
With that useful reminder that public policy actually can fix problems, has fixed problems, even if there are still problems to remain, I'm going to close up the President's inbox for this week. My guest has been Rachel Vogelstein, the Douglas Dillon Senior Fellow and Director of the Women in Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can find the Women's Power Index and all the other great work done by the Women in Foreign Policy Program at CFR.org. Rachel, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. As has been the case since we've gone to remote recording, Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.